Hello and welcome to Towards the Point, a cultural compass for Pompey and beyond. I'm James Sandy, and washed up on the shores of enlightenment tonight, we go moving with the action and consider the legacy of the swinging 60s scene. We speak to the wedding present as they stop off in Portsmouth on their current Valentina tour, and we go all geometric and partly fractal with a new exhibition of John Minot's work at the Aspects Gallery. Joining me as ever to help me sift and trawl through the driftwood are Dave Allen and Simon Mobbs. Dave, Simon, welcome.
Thank you.
Hello, thanks.
You've made it back again, that's great. We're going to start tonight with music and music scene. And Dave, you're going to tell us about the moving action.
Yeah, the moving action, I am. Well, they were moving for me. I am. I'm going to talk around a brand new book called The Action in the Lap of the Mods, which was written principally by a man from Portsmouth who was a Portsmouth mod in the 1960s called Ian Hebditch, who sadly died about 4 years ago in the course of writing the book. And his partner, Jane Shepherd, in London, has finished the book off working with two members of The Action. And for those of you out there who are not sure who The Action were, they are probably the cult mod band of the 1960s. People will know more readily The Who and The Small Faces, but The Action are the cult band because although they were always on the cusp of making it, they never quite did.
It's a great name for a band as well, The Action.
It's magical, and they were that kind of band. The music has action to it as well as the way that they performed. And they dressed like, they were Londoners, they dressed like mods. But the key reason we're talking about this on a Portsmouth radio station and on a station that's interested in Portsmouth is that they were one of the three most regular bands to play at the mod club in the 1960s, which was called the Birdcage Club, which was set up in Southsea in February 1965 and moved fairly quickly to its own premises in Eastney on the corner just by Brandsbury Park, and stayed open until the Summer of Love, when all the hippies took over and the mod thing began to slightly fade away.
And we were trying to early, just before we started recording, we were trying to identify exactly where the Birdcage Club would have been. And Simon, I think, we don't want to give his personal details away, but lives very close in the proximity of that area.
It might have been my local.
And tell us about the club itself. What kind of size was it? What kind of scene did it capture?
Okay, it had been a dancing school, and it had a sprung floor. It was one of those kind of classic small, intimate club venues that were very popular then, not cavernous at all, so 300 or 400 people would pack the place out. It had fairly simple kind of pop art, stripy, very strong graphic image around it. Seats up one side, the sprung dance floor was perfect because the mods loved dancing, and there was a DJ there called Brady, whose real name was Pete Boardman, and he used to buy singles, 45 RPM singles of American import classic soul, all that classic Motown Atlantic, but more obscure stuff, James Brown and so on. And there would be lots of dancing, and then there would be a band. And I was talking to Simon earlier about it. One of the things to understand about the 60s was what an incredible time it was for live music. People just travelled around, and bands played relatively cheap. So you could afford to put them on in those circumstances. And I mean, I was trying to reel off the names of the very popular bands. Didn't become really big. The Action and Jimmy James and the Vagabonds were not huge across the country, but you would also go there and see The Who, The Small Faces, Eric Clapton and Cream, John Mayall's Blues Breakers, and visiting Americans like Wilson Pickett and Ike and Tina Turner and Little Richard and so on and so on. So it was an amazing scene.
And so now, as you said right at the start, that The Action are kind of a cult mod band.
Yeah.
At the time, and I think they probably struggled to kind of break into the kind of hit parade, as it would have been called.
That's right.
But what kind of size was their following? Because you mentioned that, they were kind of frequent performers, very much a live band.
Yeah.
What
they were. They never, in their days as The Action, they became Mighty Baby afterwards, which was a more experimental band, and did do a couple of albums. But as The Action, they didn't do an album, for example. They did five or six singles. The interesting thing about them was that they were picked up by George Martin you know, as a kind of band to follow the Beatles, and he was sufficiently impressed by their sound, which was the sound was very interesting, because what they played predominantly were the classic soul girl groups of the early 60s. They would cover stuff by the Ronettes, Martha and the Vandellas, those kinds of people, the Marvelettes. And yet the lead singer, Reg King, had quite a harsh London voice. He didn't try and sound like a black person exactly, but he had the timing and inflections. And they didn't have saxophones and organs and things like most soul bands had. They just had guitars, including a 12-string, which gave it a kind of notably jangly, sharp sound.
So they were kind of reinterpreting those songs.
Really were,
stealing from that songbook, but taking it somewhere else rather than just a covers band.
They were.
Covering because they had to. Yeah.
They were. And you asked about the following, and I think this is an interesting question about this whole book about the action in the lap of the mods. Although it tells the tale of this particular band, it also explores the history of that subcultural group, the Mods, which had a significant revival in 1979-80 around the publication of the release, rather, of the film Quadrophenia, of course. That was kind of second-generation thing. But this explores in real detail the obsessive nature of Mods, in particularly in terms of fashion. So it's not just about music. It is about the fact that, for example, in those days, we would go round the corner from where we are now to Commercial Road and order suits. And we wouldn't buy suits off the peg like you might do nowadays. You might pop into a shop and say, yeah, that just about fits. Yep. We would have them bespoke, made to measure, you know, and you would specify a flare here or the length of a vent there. Would you have a flap or a central vent? And you know, I bought a suit recently that had a curved front on the jacket, and I didn't quite like it, really. I wanted squared, but she said, oh, no, don't do those anymore. Well, in the 60s, you would say, no, I want straight or I want curved, and you would, you know, you would specify it.
So I'm really interested in the kind of fashion and the kind of image element, because I think, you know, when we think about, well, certainly when I think about a mod, I'm kind of thinking Vespa, green jacket, British kind of Air Force target symbol, and I think that's the kind of that's a generic mod, if you like. But what you're talking about is very sort of very specific, if you like, tailor made. But you know, very smart looking,
really, really specific. Now, I said no. Some mods certainly did drive scooters, and I think it depended a lot on how old you were, how much money you had, and where you lived. And I had good friends who drove scooters, and I didn't. I mean, I most of the time when I was a mod, I was 15, 16, I was still studying, I couldn't afford a drive scooter. But by and large, the point about the parkas was that you only wore them to protect the really good clothes underneath, to get from A to B, and as soon as you got there, you know, that would come off, and you'd strut around in the, you know. I mean, my dad, for example, his oldest school friend, ran an old-fashioned tailor's in Elm Grove, where I would go and buy very subtle kind of striped blue shirts, which were kind of just two tones of blue stripe, and they weren't big stripes. It was a very subtle kind of thing that changed with the light, collarless, and I would buy from him different collars that went on with a stud, you know, and then wore a paisley tie and a paisley pocket handkerchief with that, you know, and was very distinct. I wasn't just buying anything, any old thing with a collar on it.
It sounds massively complicated going out.
Massively complicated. It was amazing.
Was there a big influence from Italy, like with the style of the clothes and the the mopeds and that kind of aspect?
It's what's really interesting was that if you go back to 59-60, Italy, as you say, and France as well, very stylish. And of course, one of the things my mum loved about it was that suddenly I was having really smart haircuts, because you had really stylish haircuts and really quite neat haircuts, and I would wear really neat raincoat overcoats to go out and to keep, you know, protect the suit. I'd wear expensive brogue shoes and things, you know, and she thought that was all really rather lovely, you know, rather than looking like a beetle, you know, with corduroy jacket and long hair and stuff, you know.
We should try and dig some evidence of this out, I think.
Yeah. Do you know the saddest thing personally, although one of the loveliest things about this book, The Action in the Lap of the Mods, is that there are some great illustrations, and in fact I did find the Pompey page, and What I'm going to do is I'm just going to find it. I'm going to pass some. Here's some Pompey mods. A picture for James to see in the book there.
Wow, they're a smart looking crew, aren't they?
The guy on the right, for instance, is a chap called Steve Conway, who I still know very well, and he's got a really neat blue suit and nice hairstyle and all the rest of it, you know. And
there's a guy on the left of this image who's not looking very happy.
No, that was Murray. He didn't always look very happy, actually. No, that's right. I don't know what was the matter with him there. Perhaps he didn't have the money to get in, because this is a picture of them hanging about outside the birdcage. But and there's little Davy in the front there with the suede jacket on, you know. And but you see that it's neat.
And
stylish, and it changed quite rapidly. I mean, that was the other thing. The changes were huge, and they weren't driven again, one of the cliches is they were driven by Carnaby Street, and it wasn't really that. It was much more subtle than that, much more interesting. But one of the things that I wanted to ask about in respect of all of this was whether those days are finished, you know, because, I mean, famously, the other story that everybody tells about the mods is the idea that you all went down to Brighton and fought the Rockers, which, in fact, very few people did. It really wasn't that serious, although there was in Palmerston Road a Rockers calf and a mods calf, and you kind of just steered clear of each other to a large extent. And they had inherited, if you like, a tradition of subcultural groups from the Teddy Boys in the 50s, and they handed it on to the skinheads and so on.
Yeah.
But my sense nowadays, you know, and now I'm terribly old and don't really know about these things anymore, my sense nowadays is that the really strong days of a minority of teenagers being committed to subcultural groups is over. And I said to you earlier before we started, I said my sense nowadays is that everybody's quite groovy.
Yeah, I mean, and that's an interesting description, I think, quite groovy. I mean, I think from my perspective, you do still get what I would call fads, or, you know, kind of bits of culture that kind of spill out into, you know, groups wearing the same things. I mean, for me, when I was in sixth form, you know, pretty much everybody had a T-shirt with the Nirvana smile, the big yellow smile that wasn't a smile.
Yeah.
Or, you know, the baby kind of underwater with the Nevermind album cover. Yeah. Or, you know, they were wearing James sit down T-shirts and flowers and all those kind of things. I think to an extent some of that is still there, but it's very, I guess it's much more commodified now because, you know, it's stuff that's bought, kind of mass-produced off the peg. It's a T-shirt and a look, which invariably is denim. It's always jeans, you know, kind of, and that goes way back. You know, that goes back to kind of the 20s, let alone, you know, kind of.
It's interesting that, like, a number of years ago, denim went out of fashion for a bit, and people started to associate it with, like, who's the guy off Top Gear?
Clarkson.
It suddenly became, like, as far as, like, young people concerned, it became a middle-aged thing, and the opposite of cool. This guy has made a revival, but it did actually go out of fashion briefly, and it.
One of the things that fascinated me about the mod revival of 79-80 was that somehow another generation that had probably only just been born when the first period, you know, finished, saw some authenticity in it. You know, they didn't see this as old blokes.
And it
was particularly blokey. But, I mean, that's another interesting question, is the extent to which the boys and the girls take a different perspective on this. But because the mod thing was quite powerfully blokey, and not exclusively so. I mean, the girl mods had styles and they dressed in particular ways and so on. Leather coats, for instance, were a big deal for the girls. But that Quadrophenia thing was really fascinating because you didn't, I don't think, get the same groundswell of let's all be hippies again. You know, everybody thinks that hippies are a bit sad and grandpa-ish, really, nowadays, it seems to me, you know.
Yeah.
But somehow with the mod thing, it's always cool.
It's interesting how, I guess, each time it comes back, it's a slightly different variation of it. If history remembers it in a slightly different way and certain elements of it are pulled out. I mean, you were talking about your youth, James. I mean, I was just a few years younger than you. And it was, I remember, like, grunge being a big thing and, like, lots of people wearing Nirvana T-shirts. But I also remember there being quite a big divide. And I don't know if it was just the era I grew up in, but they had quite a lot of people that are into, like, the rave culture and that kind of thing. And there'd be people into happy hardcore wearing these sort of... There's a local shop called Massive Records, and they would wear these kind of puffer jackets, kind of proclaiming that they are into dance. And if they walk past someone with the flannelly T-shirts and the grungy hair, it was like a bit of a, like, you're a freak, what are you dressing like that for? that. And there was definite, like, there was a bit of a kind of a tension as to which way you were going to dress and which way you were going to choose.
I do remember having a very stylish psychedelic print T-shirt with the word Splinter written across the front.
Yeah, yeah.
With a blue hood, which was way beyond me because I didn't, you know, dance culture was something that passed me by completely, I think.
Actually, now, you talk about dance culture, but here's another thing that intrigues me, which is that, in fact, this very Saturday, but occasionally during the year, and it happens once a month, in Albert Road, there is a soul club next door to the Wedgwood Rooms. It just takes place on top of the Conservative Club.
Yeah.
And you can turn up there, and it's like Northern Soul. And Northern Soul is just 2 years later than the Birdcage, really,
right,
in terms of style and in terms of the kind of music. To a large extent, it's not quite the same, but it's very, very similar. And you turn up there, and there are guys of my age in their 60s, people who went through things like the Birdcage. In fact, I go there and meet Birdcage friends there, and we talk, and I dress up, deliberately dress up quite stylishly on those nights. I don't slouch about in jeans and things. And it's really entertaining to have a dance and so on and so on and so on. But what's fascinating is that actually you get people now of all ages going to that. So you know, I went the other day, and there was a guy there called Dave who used to work at the Birdcage who was there, and his daughter, who's now at the university, she's about 21, she came, you know, and I'm talking to this 21-year-old, and I'm thinking, in the days of the Birdcage, there weren't 63-year-olds hanging about chatting to us, you know. That, and I mean, I kind of like that, in a way.
Yeah.
I like that breaking open of those constrictions and you know, all of that.
Do you think there's a certain amount of hegemony to it? Like, the mainstream culture incorporates the subcultures eventually,
yes,
and it's like, when the mainstream culture realises there's maybe money or something to be gained from these cultures, they will bring it in. And that turnaround has been happening more and more quickly as the decades have gone on. And, you know, maybe back in the 60s and 70s, something might take a good few years at least for the mainstream to kind of grab
Absolutely.
Hold of it. Now it can be you know, a year and a half, number of months almost. Yeah. And there's a certain, like James said, a certain amount of it being becoming a commodity. Yeah. It's difficult to be an individual now.
Yeah.
Because everything has been sort of like marketed, like, I mean, say for example, the punk imagery and the collages by Jamie Reid and that kind of thing, God Save the Queen and all of those kind of images. We've seen that on like kids' programs and kids' you know, T-shirts and stuff like that. So to kind of hold that up as like a rebellious image and walk around seriously thinking that you're rebelling by doing that, it's just very difficult. I mean, even say tattooing, you know, how many people have got tattoos now? It's very difficult to do something that and genuinely feel like you're being an individual. It's tricky.
You're particularly right about how long it took for things to permeate the mainstream culture. And in fact, Quadrophenia is a classic example of that, because the mod thing really lasted from about 62.3 to about 65.6. The first real film about it took another 13 years to emerge. Nobody was, because film takes a long time to prepare and set up, and nobody was quick enough at the time. They were making pop films like the Beatles films or whatever, but nobody was quick enough. The other thing about commodity, of course, just to go back to the action, is that one of the things that now makes them the great cult band, sadly even more in the sense that two of them have now died, is that they didn't go on like The Who to become something else afterwards. So they are enshrined forever in Aspic as that great band of that period, and you can only hear them play mod tunes. You can only see pictures of them as, you know, 22-year-old young mods and so on and so on, although I did meet them 3 weeks ago at the launch of the book, which was lovely. And so they can be the perfect cult band who didn't ever become old. They did die before they got old, and that's, you know, maybe that suits them down to the ground.
Now, one of the things I read about them, which I was fascinated to read, was that I think in 2000 they kind of had they reformed.
Reunion, they did.
With Phil Collins.
Yes,
of,
they did.
Of Genesis fame, for anyone who doesn't know who Phil Collins is. Now, that's a strange thing, and I think he's quoted as saying, well, for me it was like playing with the Beatles, you know, kind of the Action were my band, you know, the band that I was really kind of...
He's in the book. He gets the last word in the book and just says how much he absolutely loved them, which astonished me, because I can't claim to be a big Phil Collins fan, but I'm with him on that.
Just to wrap up, tell us about the book, where we can get it, who publishes it, how much is it, you know, it's Christmas is coming, I believe.
Well, there are two versions of it. There is a box set, which is the hardback book, and it's a very beautiful hardback book, well illustrated, and the box set also has with it a very rare single that was never issued by the Action on vinyl, and a second book, which is all about a kind of diary of the band, and again heavily illustrated and so on. It's not cheap. The box set is £70 and the book on its own, the hardback book, is £35. I'm fairly confident that it's going to be in Blackwell's in Portsmouth in the near future, if not now. The alternative is that you can go online to www.theactionbook.com. I'm biased, but I think it's fabulous.
We move now to more music in the shape of The Wedding Present, and I was lucky enough to catch up with their lead singer at a recent soundcheck just before their performance at the Wedgwood Rooms in Portsmouth. I'm very pleased to be with David Gedge of The Wedding Present. David, how are you doing?
Very well, thank you.
Excellent. Thanks very much for talking to me.
If
we can start with Valentina, which I believe is your ninth studio album.
Well, it depends how you count, really.
Okay.
I actually think it's the eighth. Because we did like a series of singles in 1992, we did 12 singles in a year, so that came out on an album called The It Parade. But to me, they're kind of singles, so I don't count that one. And then we did like a Ukrainian folk LP, which I don't really count as a Wedding Present LP. So yeah, I mean, I think it's the eighth one, but it's open to interpretation. If you include compilations and all that stuff, it'd be about 15.
So tell us about Valentina. Tell us about the kind of the theme or the kind of the focus of the album.
Well, there isn't one really, to be honest with you. I think, you know, my style is basically, I'm very interested in conversation in general. It's a very straightforward style, so there's, you know, I don't really use that much in the way of metaphor or, you know, poetic imagery or anything. It's just the usual kind of series of little stories or conversations based around you know, general relationships, really, I think. Especially the kind of the beginning of a relationship or the end of a relationship, or, you know,
so is it trying to,
a stressful time within a relationship.
Is it trying to kind of catch a sort of dialogue or kind of mood?
Exactly, yeah. That, I mean, people often say that when they see my lyrics written down. It looks more like a dialogue for a film or a play or something that rather than a pop song, which that's kind of what I've aimed to do really over the years. I've honed it down to this kind of conversational style. So, and there's no real theme, you know, in terms of the lyrics. I mean, musically there was a bit because we had a lineup change just before we recorded it, and our old guitarist left. Now, drummer became the guitarist because he could play guitar as well. But that kind of influenced the way it was kind of written in a way, because obviously, I suppose he was coming from a kind of drumming perspective. So there's a lot more in terms of like your quirky kind of rhythm things and, you know, tempo changes and stuff like that, you see, which I think possibly we wouldn't have, you know, had as much of had a guitarist been writing the tune. So yeah, it's got a quirky personality of its own, I think, musically.
I was going to ask you about lineup changes, because I think The Wedding Present are possibly one of the bands that's had possibly the most lineup changes since, I think, you started in 85, is that right? So you've been going 27 years.
Mm-hmm.
And you've had a lot of people sort of come and go, is not the right expression, but you've had a number of personnel, shall we say.
Oh, yeah, totally. I mean, I think I was the remaining original member by about 1991 or something. So it's been quite. And, you know, it's always sad when people leave, because obviously in a group you form quite a bond, because it's quite an intimate relationship. You're on tour, you're in the studio, you're writing, and you're on top of each other, basically. And then when someone goes, it's a breaking of that kind of relationship. But if I'm honest with you, and it sounds quite cynical, I think the lineup changes have kind of benefited the group, because obviously you get like a new person coming in, and they've got a new enthusiasm and sort of new inspirations and new kind of influences and things. And so each time the group goes through a little kind of rebirth, really.
And do you find, I mean, this might seem a strange question, but do you find perhaps as a constant member, because you in the band from day one, as it were, do you find that places some restrictions in terms of, you know, because you've got the sort of flexibilities of new people coming in, but do you find that there are things that you definitely want to do, or kind of things you won't?
No, I actually kind of relinquish control in a way, because I always feel that the sound of the band and what we do at any one time should be kind of based on whoever's in the band at that time, I suppose. And I think I'd be stupid not to, in a way, because I think if it was me saying, you know, it's got to sound like this and we've got to go in this direction and we've got to do this, it would end up being quite samey. You know, conversely, I'm quite proud of the fact that, you know, they've got this series of albums now, 8, 9, 10, whatever, and they've all got their own kind of unique style, in a way, you know, because they've been almost different groups through the years. So I think it keeps it kind of varied, really, and keeps it fresh, you know.
And there's kind of, I think, around sort of 4-year pause since your last studio album. Is that right? You kind of 3-4 years?
Yeah. yeah, the other side of that argument is basically, you know, we have a major lineup change like we had, it does slow the process down because obviously you've got to find someone, they've got to fit in, and they've got to start writing and stuff. So it took longer than usual because we had like a double lineup change because that guitarist who was the drummer was the first change, and then our bass player left, and we had a new bass player. So the combination of those two did slow us down a little bit.
Complicated. Now, tell me about, there's a hardback book and a film that's just been released. It was released, I think, 25th of October, which is the kind of story of a wedding present album. So the current album, Valentina.
Yeah.
This is the kind of behind-the-scenes exclusive expose. Tell me about some of the thinking behind that.
I suppose, first of all, it wasn't my idea.
Okay.
I was just approached from by somebody who works for HarperCollins, and they said, you know, would I be interested in doing this kind of like, you know, book version of the album, if you like. And I thought it was a great idea, to be honest, because, you know, I'm always interested in doing, you know, I never wanted to be one of those bands who kind of do, you know, album tour, you know.
Yeah,
it's always nice to do something a bit different. Hence, as I say, we did the Ukrainian folk music in the 12 singles. I've got my other project, Cinerama. I do my own festival. We do a comic, we do a book, and I just think the book was one of those.
So this is a kind of companion piece, which is a kind of, I suppose, a richer version of the album rather than a
kind of. Standard. I mean, because I know some bands do kind of deluxe versions of albums. And I didn't really want to do that because it seemed to me just, you know, a way of, making kind of, you know, more money out of the same thing, really. Whereas this is actually like a completely different thing. Even though, if you get the book, you can download the album, you know, free with it. But it's more about, you know, I've always been interested in those books myself. You know, the Beatles at Abbey Road and, you know, all that kind of stuff, and little documentaries and things. So, as a fan of music, I think, you know, I've always found that kind of stuff interesting. Hopefully, you know, the people will as well. And it's just about the making of the album, the lyrics are there, and, you know, and then, as you say, there's a documentary connected to it which you can view, and it's more of the same, really, you know, just how we did it.
I'm interested in how you use kind of different media, if you like, in terms of what different things bring out. And you mentioned at the start there, you, I think in 92, released 12 singles kind of consecutively across the months. Your attack on the hit parade, as it were. But I think, thankfully, you're one of the people to blame for the saving of vinyl as a format.
Yeah.
I think had a contribution. So how do you use kind of, you know, film and vinyl and sort of increasingly multimedia stuff to kind of...
I've just always been interested not just in pop music, really. I've always been interested in I suppose pop culture in general, so as that extends to books and films and comics and TV and, you know, video. And, you know, I'm kind of interested in all different aspects, even down to the record sleeves and, you know, how the record's released and all, you know, how the band looks on stage, all that kind of stuff really is interesting to me, and also I'm probably slightly obsessed with that.
Some obsessions are good obsessions, I think.
I guess so, yeah. I suppose the danger of trying to do too much sometimes, so you kind of weaken something. But so in regards to the book, I just thought it was presented to me as a really strong idea, and I thought, yeah, I would love to do this, you know, so, you know, why not?
And of course, late 90s, I think you became Cinerama, which is a sort of a side project or a separate project?
No, I totally became Cinerama because I actually, in 1997, I kind of put the wedding present on hold while I did this other, which was initially like a side project, just because I wanted to try some different types of music, really, because I've always been interested in film soundtracks, for instance, particularly the work of people like John Barry, Ennio Morricone, people like that. So I didn't think the wedding present was the right place for that, really. So I thought it'd be a bit unfair to try and drag all those people down this stupid road with me. So I started my own project, and initially I did think it would, you know, maybe for, you know, 8 months or a year or something. But in the end, I actually kind of decided that I quite liked it, and I was enjoying the kind of control, I suppose, of the whole process because I did all the writing myself at home on the computer and stuff. And so it kind of became 8 years, actually, and the wedding present was on hold.
And gradually wedding present stuff kind of crept back in?
Well, what happened was, it went from being a solo project with just me and using other musicians to actually being a band that played live. And then as that band kind of started to write the Cinerama stuff between us, it was gradually became kind of more guitar-y and kind of heading back towards wedding present territory, even though it's still quite orchestral and with string arrangements and stuff. But then we were doing this album called Take Fountain, which we all thought would be the fourth Cinerama album. And it just sounded like the wedding present, really. We came to do a session in Maida Vale in London for John Peel. And obviously I'd been in there previously as the wedding present, then as Cinerama. You know, the engineers were saying, David, you know, it's called Cinerama, but it sounds like the wedding present because, you know, there was no strings and there was no flute and there was no trumpet and stuff. So I think the penny finally dropped and I thought, well, let's just call it the wedding present because it's confusing people and I don't want people to kind of, you know, I don't want Cinerama fans to buy this and it sound like the wedding present, and I don't want, you know, wedding present fans to miss out on a new wedding present record.
Yeah, it kind of reached a kind of natural juncture, I guess.
It's kind of like a big curve, you know, not curve, I don't know what the word is. You know, it started miles away from the wedding present and in the end it kind of converged. So I think Take Fighting was kind of the point where the two bands became, you know, the same, really. And then after that, I suppose the wedding presents moved on again back into more guitar-y kind of territory anyway.
Tell me about live performance, because the wedding present and live performance is very much kind of, you know, they're synonymous with each other. You know, you've always been a kind of, I think, a real advocate of live music and,
totally, yeah,
and playing live. You've done a lot of festivals recently, and also you've played some quite curious small venues. There's some footage of you, I think, on Wedding Present TV, which is a YouTube channel. At a bike shop in Texas, which is a kind of, I think, a sort of preview gig for South by Southwest.
No, it was actually part of South by Southwest. It was actually a radio station over there called KEXP from Seattle, and they do it every year. They just broadcast from this bike shop. It's actually Lance Armstrong's bike shop, I think.
Okay,
right, better
not go into
it. I know, it's fallen into
it. And obviously, earlier you were playing at Pine Vinyl, which is another kind of curious mix of things. And that was absolutely rammed, and that was a great set as well.
It's pretty small, wasn't it?
It's very small, but is there something from the intimate performance that you get that perhaps you don't get in a bigger venue?
I mean, I think it possibly that might have been slightly too intimate in that you know, you can look up and people are literally a foot away from you. But you know, as a, you know, fan of seeing live music myself, I never enjoy the big concerts because, you know, the band are too far away, the sound's always kind of echoey around this massive room. You know, a place like, you know, the Wedgwood Rooms where we are today is perfect for me because it's a nice, small, intimate space, but at the same time it's got the production kind of values of a bigger concert, really. It's got a nice PA, a nice stage, you know, the facilities are great, so yeah, this is an ideal situation for me.
I don't want to go on about this too much, but the Wedding Present have been around for 27 years, which...
So you keep saying, you're making me feel...
I'm sorry about that, I'm sorry.
Older and older by the second.
You only look 29, so you must have started young. What's the secret, do you think? Because, you know, you've been, you know, sort of writing, performing, and it must take a hell of a lot of energy and a lot of kind of...
Well, as I said to you before you switched the microphone, I think it's probably a slight form of obsession in some way, because I do feel driven to do it. I don't know what it is, you know, I don't, you know, really do it for fun, you know. It's optically enjoyable, and I don't really do it for the money. So, especially these days, there's kind of less and less income to be made from recording music anyway. But if I don't do it, I do feel like I miss it. You know, like, you know, we're on tour now, and I'm looking forward to actually, you know, writing more songs. And then I'll be writing more songs. I'll be looking forward to recording them, and I'll be looking forward to going on tour and playing them live again. So it's, I mean, in one way, I suppose the kind of variety of the, you know, of the process is, you know, keeps it interesting, but also, yeah, I do feel, you know, very sort of addicted to it. You know, if I don't do it, I'm craving to get back there and do it again, really. So
I think you can be reassured by the fact that other people love what you do, and famously John Peel said that you've written some of the best love songs of the rock and roll era. Now I think, you know, that's something to be proud of.
Yeah, actually, I got him to fax me that, actually. He said it on the radio, and then I think it was a record label we were on at the time, Cooking Vinyl, wanted to do an XFM advert for the radio station, and so they wanted a quote. And I thought, well, yeah, use that quote. And they said apparently they can't sort of use a quote in a radio advert unless it's been, you know signed off by the person who made the quote. So he had to send me this fax, which was just because he said, well, you know, I phoned him up and or emailed him or whatever I did, and he said, I can't remember what I said now. I said, well, he actually said this, and I quoted it to him, and he wrote it out and signed it and faxed it to me. So that, I've still got the fax, obviously. So that's yeah, it was brilliant.
It's a great one for the autobiography, at least, I think.
Mm.
You've got dates coming up in Cardiff, Bristol, Dublin, Cork, Oxford, Leamington Spa, Royal Leamington Spa, we should say, Reading, but also 2013, I think February, you're touring George Best and the Hit Parade album, as it's called, and you're playing New York and Atlanta and LA, so you're kind of all points of the map, really.
Well, actually, yeah, we're doing Australia and New Zealand and Japan as well, but it's not announced yet. But yeah,
wow.
Well, we, you know, it's what we do. What we do. Well, as you said before, you're the wedding present. Are a live band. I think that's what I've always wanted to do. I imagine we will probably do the Hit Parade and George Best over here at some point again. So,
well, David, it's been absolutely great to meet you and to talk to you. Thanks very much for your time.
No worries.
And best of luck with the tour and the new album.
Thank you very much.
Thanks very much.
We move now to art and the strange shapes of John Minot. Simon, you've been exploring things in the Aspects.
I have indeed, yes. John Minot, a local painter. There's an exhibition of his work at the Aspects Gallery, and it's 30 years of abstract work. The kind of approach that he seems to take is he starts off with abstract geometrical line drawings, which he then takes through to a variety of different forms, which could be large scale acrylic painted canvases. It could be meticulously cut paper cuts, and also even moving through to things like hardboard and plywood and cutting through the forms. But it's always this idea of abstract and geometrical.
And so the word geometrical, to folks listening, how do we break that down? Is that kind of lines and frames and shapes?
Yeah, basically lines and shapes, really. And a few other words that you could use to describe his work that certainly came up with a blurb on the exhibition as well. Architecturally inspired, obsessive, subtle, accurate, precise. These are the kind of things that you probably would use to describe his work.
And he has very strong local connection.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. So he studied fine art and then trained in architecture. And then he's been living in Southsea since the 70s, I believe. He's taught at Portsmouth College of Art, and he's also had a big part to do with the art space art collective in Portsmouth, which he's been part of since the 80s. So, yeah, very much like a local artist and part of a local art scene. I believe, Dave, you were even taught by John at one point.
Yeah, I was. It was when I was going back to be a student in my early 20s, having failed to be a musician. So I was going off to evening classes, and it was in those days of the College of Art, which is the building that's being built at this present moment, almost opposite the police station in Winston Churchill Avenue, and it was then an independent art college.
Is it the Eldon Building?
Well, it is now, but that's part of the university, but it was independent, and it was just about to go into the Polytechnic, I think, in those days. And, I mean, there's another whole story to be told about the independent art colleges and how they changed as they went into higher education. And I used to go to evening classes there after a day at work and, get myself back into the swing of it. And it was a matter of chance who you might get. You got young art college lecturers who were earning a bit of extra money in the evenings, and one of them was John Minot, who I still remember vividly. I mean, he was teaching me mostly drawing, and he was very like his... I mean, I don't want to pursue this too far and suggest that people always paint somehow the way they are as people, but he was kind of like his paintings. He was precise, and he was a kind of modest, gentle, quiet man who you know, just offered you odd bits of wisdom here and there and helped you along, and he was a very nice man, and I've been aware of him around Portsmouth ever since.
Well, let's explore the work, actually, because it's some very intriguing and interesting kind of compositions, I suppose you might call them that.
Yeah.
One of the things that you just mentioned and I want to pick up on is a lot of the work, to me, instantly when you look at it, it looks like floor plans, or it looks like structural, architectural designs. It looks like the formative concept for something. And is that what abstraction's about? Is it
interesting? Yeah, one of the definitions of abstraction is that it's about a focus on internal form and an internal structure as opposed to the surface look. Mm-hmm. And also interesting, you mentioned about architecture, and he's trained as an architect as well as in fine art, and I think that definitely comes through. And it's quite interesting going to see this exhibition in Gunwharf, because you come out and you just see all of these new man-made structures around you, lots of grids, lots of windows, lots of right angles. What you could argue is that if you say American painters like Jackson Pollock are dealing with more natural forms, we live in a world where we're surrounded by man-made objects, man-made architecture, so maybe abstract art reflects that, because that's our environment. Yeah, I mean, we've got one example here which maybe we could look at, which is blue, green and yellow acrylic on canvas, which is very much like what you said. It does look like a bit of a floor plan, really. It looks like a kind of fantastical floor plan, but it's got that kind of feel to it, hasn't it? I mean, we've got a series of squares, a grid, and then we've got these kind of slightly off-kilt geometric shapes as well, which we were saying before remind us a little bit of the shapes you might see in the London Olympics logo.
But which everybody loves, I'm sure.
Greatly popular.
Indeed.
But what you've also got is, unlike the Olympics identity and logo, it's very subtle colours. This particular one is light washes of kind of pale powder blue, subtle green, subtle yellows, and lots of gradients. And it's actually got quite, although it's got quite harsh angles within it, it's got quite a soothing effect in terms of the colour. I don't know what you guys think to it. Although there's a sense of order to it, there's a lot of man-made shapes, and I find it quite a calming image to look at.
It's really interesting you should say that, because some of the notes I made when I was kind of looking around the exhibition, there is, I think, very much a sense of calm about the work. And it's hard to kind of explain that, but it's not just the colour, but the form itself is very, I think, restful. You mentioned Jackson Pollock as well just before, and one of the pieces aspects, the note I made, is that it looks like paint puddles. Now, obviously Pollock's more kind of natural rather than kind of abstraction in a sense, but I could look at this piece and think, well, I can see some of the kind of contours of things that he's tried to capture or kind of formalise in some way, if that makes sense.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I guess when we're looking at a piece like this one here, it's, I suppose, something you could consider as well is like maybe the influence of things like the Bauhaus, and what you would have, for example, with theories of the Bauhaus would be that you can break any kind of image, any design down fundamentally to building blocks, to shapes, and even in its purest form, they would suggest circles, squares, triangles, that kind of thing. And there's a certain element of minimalism, like what can you achieve with just these minimal amount of kind of ingredients, visual ingredients? You know, can you achieve these kind of harmonious, kind of sublime, you know, experiences just through shape and just through line and just through colour? Maybe that's what's kind of been trying to achieve here.
Dave, a question for you, because obviously you've had some exposure to the man and his work. Was it, when you went into the gallery, did you instantly recognise it as his?
Well, there's a difficult question. I mean, I knew it was his, so I might have been cheating. I wasn't surprised by what I saw, although I said to you earlier that I went in expecting to like it, and in a sense was rather delighted by it. I more than simply liked it. I found it absolutely delightful. I think it's conceivable that you could come across similar work by other people, and I might go in and say that looks like John Minot's and find it isn't, you know. So I don't want to push that too far, and I mean, you know, it's 40 years since he taught me for one term, so I can't say we're bosom buddies, but I found it absolutely delightful. And I think in terms of that debate about abstraction, one of the interesting things is, particularly on radio, that we're trying really hard to explain what it's like analogously, you know, it's a bit like this and it's a bit like that. There are, in a simple sense, there are two kinds of abstraction. One is the sort of abstraction that you find in Cubism, where Braque and Picasso were actually drawing and painting jugs and guitars and things and tables, and the things are still in there. They are still those things. But we call them abstracted, and yet this is different, because this isn't, as far as I can tell, referring to anything in the real world. It is what it is. It's almost Zen-like, you know. This is this.
Yeah. It's interesting. I mean, I looked at some of the work in there, thinking actually, for me, some of it is perhaps about origins of things. You know, the kind of the beginnings and the makings of particular things.
I think that's a nice thought.
Which, because when you look at it, it is about structure and it is about form, but not in a traditional way. And you know, in the way you've described some of the kind of, you know, Picasso and some of the other kind of famous, more famous artists, if you like. So, and the other thing that struck me was that, and it's interesting, Simon, you said about Gunwharf and the kind of structure of Gunwharf. Some of it I was looking at thinking, actually, is this a work of art, or is this a guide to the shopping area? You know, but that gave me a sense of, you know, it is about geometry, but also I think there's stuff about geography in there. You know, so for example, there's one piece that's very, you know, it's kind of a split image, if you like, which is a very dark blue and very light blue, kind of split down the middle with a kind of, it looks like a lightning strike. And I looked at it thinking, I think that's coastal. I think that's a coast. I think that's about kind of geography and about place, which is another whole kind of dimension.
It's interesting, because I think, even as Dave was saying, this is not really the camp of abstraction that starts with something like a still life and then takes it into an abstracted image. It's that the artist is trying to achieve an effect on the canvas without it necessarily looking like anything. But naturally, the human mind, the human eye, wants to find similarities. If you look at a Rothko with those big planes of kind of colour, you see a landscape. It's almost, you can't escape it. We just want to read images in that kind of way. And like, as we've both been saying recently, like we've all been saying, you could sort of see that there's architectural forms in here, whether he was trying to make it look like a specific building. His background in architecture, the fact that we all see architecture around us, might somehow kind of come through into it. Or maybe it is, like you say, maybe it's just trying to use the starting blocks or something. Maybe it's just shapes.
I think Simon's absolutely right about the fact that we're much more inclined to relate images to things in the real world than we are, say, a piece of music. And I think there are bits of music, particularly perhaps in the last 40, 50 years, you know, which I suppose most commonly you would think of something like Brian Eno's ambient music, but you might go to some of the pieces of Terry Riley and Steve Reich and so on and say, when you hear those, you don't necessarily demand of them that they remind you of, you know, birds singing or the sea, or they are what they are, you know, and we're not troubled by that. But when you get to art, somehow we either need it to be like something, or it comforts us to find a way of explaining that to ourselves, which is perfectly fine. I don't have a problem with it. But I think around that time as a student was when I was making that leap of understanding that you could make work that wasn't about anything except itself. And it was a it was a revelation to me and a real excitement, and it's kind of enriched my life since. That's why I'm fond of it in that sense.
The exhibition never gives any dates on the pieces of work. So there's 30 years of work here, but you could be looking at one piece that's been created a year ago and another piece which is created 29 years ago, and you wouldn't know. And his style is quite consistent over that time. You get the sense that he wants to kind of create a certain kind of continuity, that maybe one or two of them you think, okay, maybe that style of painting was particularly popular in the 70s or 80s, but you'd be pretty tricky to find out. I don't know if that rings true with you, Dave.
I think there is a certain sense in which they are works of a particular time, and British works of a particular time, and in Portsmouth in the early 70s and through the 70s, there were a number of people painting around in this hard edge abstract style, which some of whom were known as systems painters, for instance. You can understand the idea of it as a system. I think one of the sad things about the more recent young British artists, conceptual etc. fashion, and we were talking about fashion earlier, and it's interesting that it does apply to art. I think one of the sad things is that this approach to work has really rather been sidelined. It's rather been seen as old-fashioned, and I would be delighted if young artists, you know, if 18, 19, 20-year-old art students went to something like this and thought, there's something in this. Yeah. There's still a field to be ploughed here. There's still some work worth doing here.
You know what? I think one of the areas that this still does maybe take place, but in a slightly different form, is graphic design. Because the tools, a program like Adobe Illustrator, you can create things like this with something like the pen or shape tool very, very quickly. And there's a lot of graphic designers that are interested in abstract shapes. Yeah. As opposed to sort of representational images, and you can buy maybe screen prints mass produced, that kind of thing, of graphic designers' work, like how can we put it, like a kind of more a cheaper version of fine art, because these prints would only be like 40 quid a time because they've been screen printed and they're kind of available en masse. And maybe what's taken an artist like John, you know, maybe weeks and weeks to produce one of these canvases, you could produce a lot more quickly with a computer. That doesn't mean to say it's better. I think graphic designers would get a lot from looking at this kind of thing. I think that they could be influenced a lot by it. It's kind of like the only things you see other than shapes in here are numbers. There's one or two canvases where you see typographic numbers. And there's an overall feel that's quite graphic design-like. And interesting, what we were saying earlier is that some of the pieces, particularly when he starts to put a bit more vibrant colour them, really look like the Olympics logo from 2012. You know, it's like we've got an image up here. It's just like it really could be like the plans for it. it's quite uncanny.
I mean, I will confess myself as being somebody who loathed the Olympics image, and I like that. And I think the crucial difference for me is the way that it's contained within a frame. And I mean, you were saying earlier, James, about how do we know it's art and not geography or whatever? Well, the answer is it's in an art gallery, you know, which sounds you know, it sounds like a cliche, but actually, you know, post Duchamp, that's the answer, really. You know, it's art because I've stuck it in an art gallery. But actually, that device he uses of and he doesn't always contain them. There are one or two pieces that that are three-dimensional and don't have a rectangular frame, but by and large it's the framing and the presenting of them, and it's I do really enjoy them in terms of their relationship one to another. You know, there's like this whole room full of a family of these things, you know, there's cousins and uncles and aunts, I just think it's and they are different ages and different generations, you know, there's the youngsters and the older, and I'm a huge fan of it. I think it's delightful, but the framing, I think, is a big part of it.
It's a great exhibition. I really enjoyed it. I find it intriguing, and it made me think.
Yes,
which
it's
is
a nice,
you know,
word for it. Yeah,
which is the point of art. Simon, just tell us the details where folks can check it out.
Okay, so it's on until the 2nd of December at the Aspects Gallery, which is open 10 till 4 each day. It's a very subtle exhibition. It's maybe not to everyone's taste, but if you can be patient with it, there's some great, really, really impressive kind of virtuoso, really accurate work in there, and some very calming work as well.
Just before we go, we've just got time to catch up with a few local events that you might want to get along to. You can catch the Rifles playing an exclusive acoustic set at the Wedgwood Rooms on the 29th of November at 8 o'clock. It's £11 for a ticket, but the experience is of clanging garage rock sound. What more could you ask for?
I'm not sure you're going to like mine, James, but it's middle of December, Friday the 14th to Sunday the 16th, and it's a symposium about Bob Dylan. And it's at the RMA and the Eastney Cellars. It kind of switches. There's films and quizzes, and Saturday night, which is the 15th, is the Dylan Project, which is all sorts of quite well-known British rock and rollers who put a Bob Dylan band together.
I might come along to that with my healthy scepticism
and heckle.
You'll be a convert. Okay, at the number 6 cinema, there's two interesting films popping up at the beginning of December. Beasts of the Southern Wild, which is a recent film over the last few months, set to be kind of like the kind of art house movie of the year, set in a kind of fictional, semi-dreamlike, deep south kind of place, meant to be very beautiful. And on another note, The Shining has had a re-edit and it's the original director's cut, and that's also a beautiful film, but maybe in a more nightmarish kind of way. Beasts of the Southern Wild is on Friday the 7th at 7 p.m. and The Shining is on Saturday the 8th at 7 p.m. both at the number 6 cinema in the historic Dockyard.
Excellent. And if you fancy a little bit of exploration between the 1st and the 6th of December, you can join one of the King's Theatre tours, your chance to look behind the scenes and behind the stage, in fact, at Southsea's Grade 2 listed building. I'm going to try and get along to one of those. Check out details on their website. Just before we go, we must just say thanks to our friends at Pie and Vinyl and to the Wedgwood Rooms. You can also check out more information about some of the things that you've heard on the programme at our blog, which is towardsthepoint.blogspot.com. We're back on Christmas Eve, which is very exciting for our Christmas show. And also, just before I go, I'd like to say thanks to Dave Allen and to Simon Mobbs. I'm James Sandy, and that's been Towards the Point. Towards the Point is a King of the Buttons production for 93.7 Express FM.